Blog Talk Radio.
It's a beautiful day and a fine time for healing. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert and compassionate coach for clients worldwide, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being is all that matters. Randy Fine is the author of the highly acclaimed groundbreaking book on narcissistic abuse, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind. This book changes thousands of lives every day. Let it change yours. Today's broadcast of A Fine Time for Healing is proudly sponsored by Massage Envy. Massage Envy is continually looking to evolve your total body care experience by enhancing your personal wellness through innovation and personalization. Massage Envy is also the number one skincare provider in the United States, offering a large variety of professional skincare treatments. With over 1,100 clinics across the United States, you are sure to find one conveniently located wherever you are.
Well, good morning. Thank you for tuning in to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Today's special guest, author Dr. Jane Rigney Battenberg, a seasoned therapist and neurolinguistic programming master trainer, has released her informative, entertaining, and vital guide to building the skills needed to navigate today's increasingly chaotic and technology-oriented world. Her book, Change Within, Change the World, helps you reflect deeply and thoughtfully about your inner beliefs and values so that you can best align them with your larger purpose and move past the artificial limitations people often impose on themselves in their habitual daily lives. Jane Battenberg has more than 25 years of experience as a therapist and trainer with a doctorate in clinical hypnotherapy, a master's degree in teaching from Washington University, and a certification as a master trainer of neurolinguistic programming, among many other things. Dr. Battenberg offers workshops and counseling to clients in the U.S. and Europe and currently resides in Medford, Oregon. To learn more, please visit changewithin.com. So, let me introduce you to my special guest today, and we're going to get started. Good morning, Jane. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
It's great to have
it's
you.
Great to be on your show.
Thank you.
It's
thank
great
you.
To
it's
be good. On your show.
You're breaking up a little bit. You're breaking up now a little bit.
There.
Okay, that's good. So, your book. Why don't you tell us what the motivation for writing your book is, and that would be a great way to start.
Oh, thank you. For years, I've worked on myself and on clients trying to change sticky problems or issues that just don't seem to go away, and I kept looking for ways to do that, and then began writing articles and blogs. And then I thought, well, you know, all this at work, it seems to form a book. But then, in order to not have it fall into another self-help book, I needed to contextualize it in a larger arena, a larger format. And I started looking out at the world, and I said, oh my gosh, you know, we're pretty much at the 11th hour for a lot of issues. And so I needed to, like, look at the largest fractal I could find for consciousness evolution to see where we're at in that. So then I did a lot of research and wrote that, and that became the external reality, and then all the blogs and inner techniques were the internal reality, and I realized that internally, whatever we create gets projected out on the external world. And so the book is about changing within to change the external. It's a
okay.
Short answer.
That's, right. That's great. That's great. You know, and that's kind of what I took from the book when I read it. And we're going to talk about, you know, that ripple effect and how all that takes place. But there are a lot of theorists and people who have talked about this that you have discussed in the book and quoted. In the beginning of the book, you talk about a consciousness evolution, and you talk about, I've got Jean Gebser, but it's probably Jean, Juan, I don't know. Anyway, a man of extraordinary vision who identifies five stages of human consciousness and the transitions as they evolve. And you talk about the archaic, magic structure, mythical structure, mental rational structure, and integral structure. So what are these structures, and how have we evolved, according to this theorist?
He's a very deep thinker. He says that we are at the rational stage, at the end of the rational stage. So, you know, looking out on the world, you know, it's good to be rational. So, you know, you can see how we're at that rational stage. And then the integrative stage is the next one to come that we're trying to evolve into. And I think he, you know, studying him, I began, then I studied Teilhard de Chardin and Elizabeth Satoris and lots of others, and I found the same patterns repeating, which were, we're sort of at the end of one era, one large, you know, consciousness. And if we don't, it's like a chrysalis for the butterfly, you know, it either turns into a butterfly or it turns into mush. So we've either got to change or or mush.
Right. You know, it starts off with, so, you know, just to give my listeners a hint, it starts off with the archaic structure, which is instinctual and primal. So we're going back into time, you know, eons. And then the second one was the magic structure as is egocentric, a transition from the one-dimensional, undifferentiated state of archaic. And then we have the mythical structure where we become two-dimensional, but we disengage from unity with nature and develop a sense of self and ego. And then the mental rational is our current stage. And as you were saying, and I'm getting this from your book, you wrote this, as I'm getting this, you know, you were talking about being in transition between the rational and integral. So what is the integral stage? Where will we be when we get there?
Rather than get into theory, let me just talk about the situation in the world, and then I'll come back to that. We're at a place in the world where no longer can one nation solve any of these issues, like climate change. If one nation reduced their carbon output to zero, it still wouldn't solve the climate change issues. So we need to all work together. And we haven't had that before, where issues are so complex and so interrelated, like climate change and mass migration are linked, and terrorism and cyber crimes and all of those are so interrelated that even if you deal with one, they're all interrelated, and you've got to deal with the whole.
Okay.
So looking out at the world, it's no longer can an individual or a nation solve them. So we're going to have to cooperate and create some sort of integrative solutions in order for the planet to survive, I think, without being too dire.
Okay, that makes sense, absolutely. And so Teilhard de Chardin famously said, we've all heard this quote, we are spiritual beings having a human experience. He saw humans continuing to complexify until we arrive at a terminal position, which he called the omega point. So what is the omega point? Can you explain what that is?
Well, sort of. He was such a great thinker that it's not up to me to put his words, but we're coming to a point like the butterfly, you know, in the cocoon. You know, we've either got to transform or change into something different.
Okay.
Or we just won't make it. So
okay.
This omega point is spiritual and vast, and, you know, it's going to require a different way of thinking. Who was it? Buckminster Fuller that said you can't solve, Einstein said you can't solve any of the issues at the level in which they were created. You have to go to a higher level of integrative thinking in order to solve those.
So it's all within the same kind of, and that's why you talk about it, because it's talking about the transition and what we have to do as people. We have to evolve. You quote him as saying, remain true to yourself, but move ever upward toward greater consciousness and greater love. At the summit, you will find yourselves united with all those who from every direction have made the same ascent. For everything that rises must converge. I like that. What do you think he meant by that? Everything that rises must converge. That when we all evolve, we all become one. Is that kind of what he's saying?
I think that when we evolve, we get so much more complex. It requires us to be more systemic and more integrative and more cooperative with each other without losing our individuality. There has to be a way, or there have to be ways in which we create a unity, a universal system that allows everybody to be individual at whatever level they're at, and still the whole works.
Okay.
And so
okay,
I think what
thanks.
He's... Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm sorry, keep going.
Well, I think what he's saying is that at the highest level, it's going to be love. It's going to be an emotion of love and a caring for each other that is going to bring us to the next level.
Okay, and that, you know, and that brings me to, I'm going to skip around here because, let's see, that's really important. Because you talk about how we're moving into a time where young people are more telepathic and are going to be more telepathic. And so... You were saying recently there's been an increase in transparency and telepathy. And Dr. Satoris, which we'll backtrack a little bit, observed that the young people today through social media communication are building a simplified shorthand of abbreviations and emotions. I found this extremely interesting, and you quoted her by saying, by reducing the amount of text and adding symbols for emotions, something very interesting is going on because the person you're talking to knows how you're feeling in that moment, and that sets up an energy field. This can communicate without time-space interference. When you don't have to think up so many words and are making this emotional connection, you are setting up a situation in which telepathy can build very easy. So we're kind of talking about emoticons and the shorthand that young people have, right?
Yes. Yes, and yes, yeah. They, looking at the young people today, I almost just don't understand them. I mean, it's like they're a different species sometimes. I mean, sometimes it's, you know, they're like us, but they've developed skills by using technology that we didn't have when we were growing up. They have developed skills and attributes that, you know, that are completely foreign. Like, I have an iPhone, and when I don't know what to do with my iPhone, I wait till I take a trip, and at an airport I look around for young people and I say, hey, can you help me do this? And they immediately fix it, you know, and they're eager to do that. It's really nice that they're so friendly. And and I'm thinking, wow, how did they learn that? How do little four-year-olds get on a computer and do what they do? It's just, it's amazing. So
what do you think is going on? You know, how do you think? So is this evolution kind of a natural thing where, I know that you talk about in the book how when one person does something that it can change everything. Let's talk a little bit about the 100th monkey effect. Can you explain what that is? I really like this.
Okay. There is a story, and I don't know if it's true. It's probably just a story, but monkeys on an island began washing their sweet potatoes to get the sand off, and then other monkeys on the island began doing the same, and pretty soon monkeys all over the world were washing their sweet potatoes. So it seemed to, like, jump time and space to go to other monkeys. So then I found in one experiment they did with mice in England, the mice learned to run a maze faster. And then pretty soon, the mice in the U.S. were running the same mazes faster. And I'm thinking, wow. So there's something to this, like Roger Bannister broke the four-minute mile. And now at least seven high school students have broken the four-minute mile. It's like you stand on the shoulders of those that come before you. And there seems to be some kind of spark that just spreads. So... let's see. Rupert Sheldrake said, there's a morphogenic field. And so humans have a morphogenic field that that whatever you do contributes to this whole human field. And it can spread, not logically or not rationally or, you know, overtly, but it just seems to happen. So... this telepathic ability, I think, is related to that. I lost the question now.
That's okay. We were just talking about the 100th monkey, but you got it. You got it. You explained it really well. So you did. You really explained it well, even though you think you lost track, but you didn't. You did really well. Yeah, and I find this, you know, this is really fascinating to me because I think about the young people too, and I do the same thing. I mean, I have kids. I remember being in a grocery store, and I couldn't get the app that I use there to work. And the kid said to me, well, enlarge it. I'm like, how do I do that? Give me the phone, she says. And like in 1 second, she did it, scanned it, gave it back to me. You know, it's they just speak that language. It is truly amazing to me, and I really wonder, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Did the children just adapt to the changes, or did the changes come because humanity was ready for that evolution? You know, it's the chicken and the egg kind of argument.
Right.
Do you have a feeling on that?
I think everything you said is true. You know, the kids grew up differently with more technology. We're at a consciousness evolution point where we're at the end of an era. And I think so all of that, I think, contributes, including the 100th monkey, you know, that the kids today are different, are changing, are, you know, Snapchat and Twitter and all this stuff, that's their medium that we never had before. So that whatever you do habitually changes your brain. And I think their brains are different. So,
right. And so you think something that's changed within humanity, that it's, you know, now the children are being born into this and almost have the affinity for it, natural affinity for it?
Yeah, and Teilhard de Chardin said, you know, we keep evolving and we keep complexifying and we keep moving up. So I think it's just a natural evolution, if you will, that this is going to happen. We won't stay the same as we were in the 1920s, say.
No, we certainly are not the same. And we aren't the same as we were in the 1960s. Very, very different, you know. And maybe even the 80s. I mean, if people come back who have passed away in the 80s and came back now, they wouldn't even believe it. They'd think we're living in a sci-fi world.
It's true.
But we've all we've all naturally adapted to it and become reliant on these changes. So let's see. So Dr. Elizabeth Satoris, she was one who rejected the premise and the implications of Western science, or the Darwinian view, that the universe is dead and accidental mutations cause evolution and only the fittest survive. Instead, she adopted a radically different approach, a Vedic science based on a living universe. I know this is a large concept. Can you explain what her thought process was there?
I think she looked out and saw that at the world and said, you know, this isn't leading us where we want to go. And every time she looked at the living universe, it seemed to have an intelligence that informs the people, informs life rather than life creating sort of randomly or haphazardly. There seems to be a pattern or an intelligence about things that, as rational beings, if we say, okay, we can create whatever we want, we're missing the larger context that we're part of, that nature and life and some kind of implicate order informs us and shapes us rather than we're shaping it.
So, yeah, scientists are holding on to more of the Darwinian theory, and which you're saying is the view that we shape the world instead of the world shaping us, right?
Yes. So if we are a part of the whole, then we don't try to destroy it, or we get a sense that we're part of everything and that we need to take care of everything without trying to control it or destroy it. So I'm just thinking about, okay, so we're taking things out of the earth. We're taking oil and coal and, you know, all kinds of stuff out of the earth without any sense of what it does to the whole. Water, you know, if we take water out, are we conscious of the large aquifer that feeds the rivers and springs and stuff? So I think it just says we've got to look larger at the larger patterns and be aware of being a part of the larger whole and stewardship over what we can. I think Elizabeth Satoris talks about bacteria, and when the earth was first formed, there was just bacteria, and they were feisty and, you know, competitive, and they ate up all the food. And then they realized, oh my gosh, we're about to not survive. So they began grouping together to form a one-celled being, and then multi-cells, and then out of that came creatures and animals and humans. And so they had to cooperate. So they moved from the feisty competitive stage to the more cooperative stage. So I think that's kind of where she's saying, you know, it's living. It informs us. We need to be a part of it responsibly and cooperatively.
That's really interesting about the bacteria. I never knew that. That's fascinating. Yeah. Well, what we came from bacteria. Who knew? I wanted to change it up a little bit. And in Chapter 11, you talk about what's really important. When you're caught up in a problem or emotion, you're really bogged down in the details of it with no big picture perspective. And then, so to move to a bigger perspective, you ask the following questions. What's my higher purpose for this? What's my ultimate intention? What is this problem an example of? How do we solve problems using the hierarchy scale? So that's my question is, how do we solve problems using the hierarchy scale, which is what we're talking about here?
Okay, so if you, so there's a problem. And you look at that problem, but you can't look at it at the level that the problem was created, like I said before, that it requires a higher thinking. So you say, all right, this is a problem. Let's go laterally and say, are there other similar problems? And what are those problems? And then you can go higher and say, okay, what is this problem an example of? So which takes your thinking up to a higher higher level of thinking. And then you say, okay, let's see, let me give an example. So I have a problem with schools, you know, with my child in school. And what is that an example of? Well, that's an example of maybe a whole school system or the governing of schools, or, you know, you look higher than what the specific problem is to get a larger perspective. Is that making sense?
Yes. And how does that help us solve the problem? How do we,
so
what does
look,
that do with us? Okay, how, what is the process that happens with us?
Okay, so say I'm looking at a school system and I say, oh, this is a problem with this school. Then I look larger and I say, oh, but all the school systems in the entire state, do they have this problem? And if so, do I go into a governmental thing to change policy? Or do I just stay locally and join the PTA and do something there to fix it? It's like, where do I insert myself to make a difference? Does that?
Okay.
And so
yeah.
It might be at a federal level, or it might be at a statewide level, or it might be a curriculum, or it could even be a belief about education that needs to be addressed.
Okay.
Or
now, what if we go laterally? What if we go laterally? How would we do that?
Here's the problem with the school. Do other schools have this problem? That would be lateral. Or do other educational systems have the same problem? Or let's say, in addition to education, you might say, okay, corporations, do they have this issue when they deal with their employees? So you look laterally to see where other problems might, you know, so you could get ideas. Have other areas solved this problem? Or is it, it might be a question of values. You know, what is this school system valuing that maybe a night class would not value, and they don't have that same problem? Or maybe training in a corporation, maybe the training they give doesn't have this problem. Oh, well, what can we learn from that? Or maybe go to another country to say, does this country have this problem? What are they valuing that we're not valuing? Or what is it, a question of beliefs and values? Or is it a question of organization or monetary? Who's funding it? You know, so you have to look at the larger picture to see. It's like a nail that's in a hole and you're wiggling the nail back and forth to pull it out of the hole. You need to to widen your view to look for solutions in other places. To see where should I go in? Where should I go in? I should go in it. Go ahead.
Can we use the hierarchy scale for all problems? So say we're having a relationship issue. How would we use the hierarchy scale for that?
Okay. This, if you have a relationship problem, then you can move up the scale. So I disagree with my partner. Where would we have a vacation? My partner wants to go, he wants to go someplace where he can be by the beach and do activities, and I want to just relax. And so we're arguing about where we're going to go on vacation. So we go up the scale to where we agree. So we go up and we say, all right, we agree that we want a vacation together and we both want to have fun and not, you know, spend a huge amount of money or whatever. And so that's where we agree. And then we start moving back down the scale into specificity to solve the problem. So it first moves us up to where we agree. Okay, if we start to disagree, we just go back up to where we agree. And then we move back down into the details of it to work things out.
That's great. Yeah, let's hear another example.
Two people own a business together, and they can't agree on the wallpaper for their office. And they're really fighting about this wallpaper. So then a consultant comes in and says, well, what are you two in business for? Well, we're in business to make money and make a difference in the world. Okay, so if you chunk up to that level, then wallpaper is insignificant. It's really what you're about at the higher level that's important. So then they go, oh, yeah, okay. So we'll hire a consultant to come in and do the wallpaper or whatever. And so we'll continue to, you know, earn money and make a difference in the world.
Okay, that's a good example. That illustrates it really well. So I could see where, you know, so it, with really any problem, we go to the place where the place of acceptance or agreement.
Because
sometimes there's not another person involved, really, that you can discuss it with. So we would go to really a place of acceptance or agreement, right? Where we, the smallest component of it, or I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying. Can you say what? You know, so if we're having a problem that we have nobody to really discuss that with, where do we go in our head with that? I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Okay. So it's like wiggling the nail loose from the hole. You say, okay, this problem is, and then you go up. It's an example of, and then you might go up to your beliefs or your values or your habitual way of thinking about it. You go up above that to say, well, what am I really, really valuing here? What is my belief about this? Does my belief need to change? Does my value about something need to change? And then you start going back down into the specificity of it to say, well, I can go laterally, and you can go laterally and say, okay, do other people have this same problem? Where does this problem exist in other arenas? Or where do I have this problem in my life? You know, maybe it's not maybe it's a pattern that reoccurs. And so you look, laterally to see, well, maybe this isn't an isolated example. Maybe there are other places in my life. And, oh, yeah, I've been doing this all my life. Or, oh, I had the same thing happen to me in grade school.
Oh, wow.
So.
Okay, that's powerful.
Then you go back down into the detail of it. You say, okay, all right, given that, do I need to change my belief? Do I need to change, hey, the buck stops here. Let's stop doing this. I'm going to change things. And in order to change something, maybe you need to change your idea about it. Well, if I do this, then give an example. So I want to go on a diet, but I can't seem to stay on the diet. Well, what am I valuing about the diet? Well, I'm valuing health and longevity, and maybe I'm going to be able to see my grandkids graduate from high school, and oh, well, that's really important. So then you'd stay on the diet because you're valuing something higher.
Wow. This is so important. It really is an important problem solving. And what it tells us is that there's always a solution. There's always a way out of a problem. It's never one-dimensional, and we're never stuck in it. Because we can go in these, we can go up, we can go lateral, and work on it from a different perspective. I really, really like that. So thanks for sharing that. The last thing I wanted to cover is in Chapter 15, you talk about using time to transform. And you use examples of people with multiple personality disorders to illustrate what you're talking about. So, can you elaborate a little bit on that? I thought that was really interesting, too.
Okay, can you be a little bit more specific, or let me just...
Okay, sure. Let me go into here and see what I was looking at. Chapter 15. So we're talking about... Well, let's just talk more general, then. Let's just talk about using time to transform. How do we use time to transform, just in general?
Ah, okay. So I think I had a quote in the beginning of that. Let's see.
It's a poor sort of memory that only works backwards. Lewis Carroll.
That's it. There you go.
Okay.
If you go back in time to an event way back that maybe started a pattern, like say maybe early in childhood or even in the womb or, some past life or something. If you go back in time to the first time that happened, that pattern happened, and you made a decision oh, I'm never going to trust people, you know. But then that decision gets carried forward through your entire life as a template to not trusting people. So if you go back in time, the unconscious mind takes time as everything's is as if now. So if you go back in time, your unconscious mind thinks, oh, that's now. And so then you remake the decision, or you look at it with your, you know, mentor, that little you or whatever, to make a different decision rather than, oh, I'm never going to trust people, to, oh, people have my back and they're always there for me. I may not see that it right away, but they're, people are always helping me. So then you move that belief or that decision all the way forward to now, just moving along your, along time, along your lifeline, to install a different decision. Then you notice, oh, I would have done things way differently. I wouldn't have married that person. I would have gone to school, you know, whatever you've done based on can't trust people, change that to everyone's there to help me.
Wow. Interesting.
Then you get back to now and you try to find those old feelings or those, the fear or the not trusting people. And if it's not there, you've literally installed a different pattern, a different lifeline. And the unconscious mind, okay, it gives you what it thinks you want habitually. Then if you change that, your unconscious mind says, oh, I like this way much better. I like thinking that everyone's going to help me. So then, from then on, your entire life, it changes. And you do things differently.
It's fascinating. That's really great. So we're running out of time. We're talking today about your book, Change Within, Change the World. And Jane, where is this book available?
This book is available on Amazon, on Google, Barnes & Noble. Almost you can order it, or if your bookstore doesn't carry it, you can ask them to order it.
Okay, perfect. And your website is changewithin.com?
Right.
Okay. And one more question is, so you do you work directly with people, helping them through these? You know, I know you're a therapist. Are you still working as a therapist?
Yes, and it's easy to work with people worldwide via Skype or Zoom or phone. So sometimes that's even better than in person, because then they can just focus inward and don't have the external distraction.
Okay, so if someone wants to work with you, they can find you on your website, or should they email you?
Both, either one, or call me. So my email.
If you want to
give
that
Jane,
information, okay.
Mm-hmm. My email is jane@changewithin.com, and my phone number is in the U.S. is 714-296-9594.
Okay, perfect. All right.
All right.
Perfect. So anyway, it's, I told you we were going to have a good conversation, because this, you know, this book is fascinating. You just touch on some really, it really sparks the imagination and really makes you wonder about things that you didn't think of. Not sparks the imagination, expands. It really expands on the way that we think. So it's an awesome book. Great job. Thank you for writing it. It's been great having you. I have to say goodbye.
Thank you, Randy.
Okay. Take care. Be well. We are out of time today. But if you want to contact me or have any questions for me, my email is randyfine.com. I keep wanting to put that G in, but I took it out. randyfine.com. Anyway, may joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.